A move by federal regulators is sure to cause debate in this new year. This week, for the first time, the Environmental Protection Agency starts regulating greenhouse gases from power plants and other big polluters. The rules apply only to new construction and major expansions, but they are already controversial. Critics contend these rules will drag down the economic recovery. Here's NPR's Elizabeth Shogren.
Old Dominion Electric Cooperative was trying to get permits for a massive new coal-fired power plant in Virginia. But last fall, it delayed the project. David Smith, the utility's director of environment, says there were two main factors: the recession, which was cutting demand for electricity, and uncertainty about EPA's greenhouse gas rules. Smith says he still hasn't figured out how the new rules will change his project, but one thing is certain: they give a new weapon to the plant's opponents.
The environmental organizations, I mean, their goal is to challenge any coal plant. Another regulation just gives them another avenue to make another challenge.
Attorney Cale Jaffe from the Southern Environmental Law Center has been fighting the plant.
Now, finally, we've got the rules that are beginning to require power companies to account for their global warming pollution. That's a historic turn of events.
Jaffe says he hopes the utility will reconsider and opt for a cleaner energy source, like offshore wind power. For EPA's supporters, examples like this are proof that the rules will work to constrain global warming pollution. But in the eyes of critics, they show how the rules will deflate the economic recovery. Jeffrey Homestead, who headed EPA's air pollution office under President Bush, predicts the new requirements will increase energy costs and halt industrial construction. That's because there's no clear rule book. Officials will evaluate each project to see what technologies could cut its pollution.
It slows everybody down because nobody has an idea what the rules are going to be.
Homestead, who now represents energy companies as a lawyer, says companies that do try to get permits will be stymied by red tape and challenges from environmental groups.
That is a huge part of the problem. There are multiple opportunities for it to be challenged and held up.
We'll be able to issue these permits. We will not slow down the economy.
Gina McCarthy now heads EPA's air pollution office. She says agency and state officials will only require companies to use existing technologies, but in ways that make plants as energy efficient as possible.
So that the pollution they emit is as minimal as possible to get the job done.
A number of power companies and refiners say the new rules won't stop them from expanding over the next few years. Some already have permits for upcoming projects. Others are replacing coal-fired plants with cleaner natural gas plants, so they won't face global warming regulations yet. But even more significant restrictions are on the way. Just before Christmas, the EPA announced it will set standards for how much carbon dioxide pollution power plants and refineries can release. The incoming head of the House Energy Committee, Fred Upton, exploded when he heard the news. He and other Republicans and some Democrats from coal mining states are vowing to stop the EPA when the new Congress gets to town. Elizabeth Shogren, NPR News, Washington.
With college application deadlines looming, 'tis the season of high anxiety for high school seniors. Around the nation, there have been efforts to ease the pressure, but as NPR's Tovia Smith reports, getting schools and parents and even some kids to ratchet it down is easier said than done.
Welcome to what you might call the calculus class, formerly known as AP.
But the integrals are so delightful.
Oh my goodness. Yeah.
It's definitely new math at this private school outside Boston called Beaver Country Day. Gone are those fat old textbooks and piles of advanced placement practice tests. Instead, students like Sophie Dietz are learning complicated concepts like integration by parts by making videos about them.
I want the calculus being like a scary monster and then we being like superheroes. I know, right?
It's exactly the kind of high-energy, low-stress kind of learning that Beaver administrators like Peter Gao were hoping for when they decided a few years ago to eliminate AP classes.
I think that pressure to make sure that you had that trophy on your transcript was something that we felt wasn't necessarily that healthy for kids. It didn't seem appropriate to be playing into that.
Gao insists his bold move hasn't hurt Beaver kids applying to college, but especially in affluent, highly educated communities, many wouldn't dare risk it, given the hyper-competitive, ever-escalating frenzy around college admissions.
It is an arms race. It just keeps going up.
That's Lee Coffin, admissions dean at Tufts University, one of the few colleges making even a small move to unilaterally disarm.
Now, if you step back and say, let's take a breath, the risk is that the pack runs past you.
Colleges are under pressure to top the national rankings and look most selective, but Coffin says Tufts is now refusing to play the data game.
I'm not trying to be holier than thou as I say this, but I think these are ways that the colleges have unwittingly poured some gasoline on the frenzy, and it all just gets a little bit more and a little bit more and a little bit more intense. And there are very few rewards for disarming.
No one wants to be the first one off the treadmill and looking at things differently.
Vicky Abeles is a mom from California who produced The Race to Nowhere, a documentary about kids collapsing under the pressure to achieve. The film is becoming something of a rallying point for frustrated parents who are now pushing for change from the bottom up.
Just last week, we had a parent get up and say, you know, at some point it comes down to civil disobedience. If a bunch of us just say we're not having our young kids who are in elementary school do the homework or we're going to keep them home on the test day, I think that you're seeing parents and educators feeling much more empowered.
But for every such conscientious objector, there are other parents pushing back. In Rockford, Illinois, for example, when the school board proposed cutting AP classes, Maggie Kosicki complained it would be academic suicide for her kids.
That very much scares us if they take this stuff away. We are definitely thinking about private school. We have to make sure our kids can get into college.
For the most part, school administrators are just as wary about doing something as drastic as dropping APs. Bob Weintraub is principal of the public high school in Brookline, Massachusetts.
The reality on the ground is you have to have AP courses on your transcript and you have to have A's and B's in them in order to get into these great schools. That's just reality. So, you know, it might sound harsh, but that's life. Sometimes there's stress, and so maybe this is good preparation for that.
Instead of eliminating stress, many schools are focusing on teaching kids to better handle it, with everything from yoga classes and breathing exercises to therapy dogs and more time for students to vent.
Everyone's getting deferred. Everyone
is getting deferred. That's what makes me so nervous to
That all may help, but Beaver Country Day School senior Julia Cohen says even the most supportive schools can only do so much, since the pressure to get into a top college really comes from everywhere.
People automatically ask you where you want to go. And that just like always provides more stress. And it's just like my dentist asked me. And I was just like,
it just drowns you. You just get so eaten up by it.
Beaver's head of college counseling, Peter Gao, agrees. The whole system is like an evil machine that's consuming kids, he says. Our school has defanged it, but only as much as any one school can. Tovia Smith, NPR News.
While we're on the subject of 3D, we wondered how eagerly Americans are rushing into the third dimension in movie theaters and on television. So we've called up David Cohen, who's an editor at Variety, where he covers 3D, and he joins us now from NPR West in Culver City, California. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Robert. First-time guest, long-time listener.
And around this time last year, Avatar was on its way to record-breaking box office receipts because a lot of people were going to see it and because they were willing to pay more to see it on 3D. So we were starting to hear the obits for 2D. A year later, what's the score?
I would say that what you're seeing this year is 3D having some growing pains but continuing to grow. When we look at 2010... most of the run of Avatar was in 2010, so there's a vast clump of box office in 3D at the beginning of the year, and then that was followed up by Alice in Wonderland, which was also a monster hit, fueled in great measure by 3D. What you then began to get into, though, was efforts of the studios to sort of exploit the format, because with 3D, they finally found something that they can charge extra for.
Mm-hmm.
So the incentive is to just get something that's 3D out into theaters and charge extra for it, whether it's really good or not. And so you had some inferior 3D titles, that is to say where the 3D wasn't very good, which is a separate question from whether the movies are good. And I say that's where the format began to run into some pushback.
Well, is a 3D movie something now that kids are coming to expect as a part of the experience of going to the movies?
Well, certainly if you look at the number of animated films and the percentage of animated films that are coming out in 3D, I think we are educating a whole generation of young moviegoers that 3D is what movies are supposed to look like. And those young moviegoers, as they mature, will not have any problem putting on glasses to watch a movie and will just take it for granted that that's how you watch a film, is in 3D.
Now, on to 3D television sets. I've read that so far sales were disappointing this past year.
Well, remember that 3D television sets are so far very much a niche product. They're at the upper end of the product range for everybody who makes them, and there's not a lot of content. But what I'm also hearing is that within the content creators, the studios, the networks, and the consumer electronics companies, the video distributors, there's an unprecedented joint effort to avoid the chicken and egg problem that has plagued things like color and HD and rollouts in the past, so that everybody's working together so that when you go to the store and buy a 3D unit, you can have something to watch when you get home. But at the moment, it's really not a mass product. On the other hand, no one expected it to be, really. I think that you're in a 10-year rollout, and you're in about year two now, maybe.
Well, looking ahead, David, do people who keep track of 3D figure that it is coming at us slowly but inevitably, or that it's maybe a boom that's fizzled out a bit, or that we can't tell yet?
You know, it's a funny thing with 3D. I've been in the Variety archives, which go back to 1905, looking at the early coverage of stereoscopic cinema, going back to the first 20 years of the 20th century. And at that time, everybody assumed it was coming any day now. And in fact, in the 1920s, people were skeptical about sound the way people are now skeptical about 3D, because it had been tried and it had always failed. Well, as soon as it was successful, that skepticism vanished and we don't even remember it. I think with 3D, we're at a similar phase. It had been tried a lot of times, it's always failed, and there's still a lot of skepticism around it. But I think what you're going to see is a transition to 3D similar to what happened with color, where the TV networks went all color. So what you have is this sort of symbiosis. You have TV going 3D, you have movies going 3D. As long as they're both going 3D, that will continue. If 3D television fails, either because consumers lose interest or it proves to be dangerous for your health or for whatever reason, then you might see this 3D boom fizzle out. Otherwise, I think it's not just a boom. I think it's a wave that's going to eventually become how movies are made. It will just become another tool for movie makers.
Well, David Cohen of Variety, thanks for talking with us here in 1D.
Thank you very much.
It's David Cohen who follows 3D issues for Variety, where he's an editor.
Today's last word in business is magic flute. The flute you're hearing wasn't handcrafted or put together in a factory. It came out of a printer, a three-dimensional printer, designed by a student at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology. A 3D printer is a machine that churns out actual objects using digital designs. In this case, it took about 15 hours for the device to create the various parts of the flute. After some additional assembly, voila, the flute was ready to play. Musician Seth Hunter tried it out and comments on this video posted online.
So it sounds perfect in terms of the acoustics. If you just fix some of the keys matching together, I think this thing will feel good.
3D printing technology has been around for a few years, and it's being used to create an ever greater variety of objects. Researchers at Cornell University, for example, are reportedly working on a printer that spits out real, edible food, like cookies. Instead of ink, you pop in, say, liquid cookie dough cartridges, adjust for the desired level of chewiness, and then print. It may be more efficient than beating the sugar and butter yourself, but with 3D printed cookies, there is no spoon to lick. That's the business news on Morning Edition from NPR News. I'm Steve Inskeep.
And I'm Renee Montaigne.
Those messages, by the way, were made public by Deadspin, a sports blog that is part of the Gawker empire. Gawker websites obsess over celebrities mocking media, fashion, politics, sex, Hollywood, and Silicon Valley. They often get celebrities into trouble and sometimes get Gawker into trouble. When Gawker posted a leaked excerpt from Sarah Palin's new book, a judge ordered the site to take it down. Now Gawker's founder, Nick Denton, is working on a redesign that he hopes will alter its reputation. Jesse Baker reports from New York.
There's an office party going on for Gawker's West Coast tech writers. They're just some of the 130 people working for Nick Denton around the country. But Denton doesn't want to get me a drink. He wants to show me what he calls the big board.
It's like a NASDAQ for content.
It's a massive flat-screen monitor, constantly updating in real time Gawker Media's top stories.
It's a scary prospect for some people. It's exhilarating for most of our staff.
And it's a board Denton tracks even more obsessively than he would, say, a child star on an ankle monitor. Jessica Cohen is editor of Jezebel, a Gawker site for women that considers itself the antidote to glossy magazines. Cohen says getting page hits is crucial, but so is getting the story first.
Nick is very much of the mind that you do it now, and the emphasis is to get it out there and be as correct as you can, but don't let that stand in the way of getting the story out there.
The idea for the original site came to Nick Denton when he was working at that most respectable old school newspaper, the Financial Times.
The stories that I would like to read about are not the stories that appear on the FT's front page or inside pages, but the stories that journalists tell each other after hours.
Denton would have you believe that after work, journalists dish about the latest Hollywood starlet to be dumped. And, okay, maybe he's right. Denton is in his mid-40s, British, and so unimpressed by American journalistic ethics that he'll go where most American journalists wouldn't dare. Denton will pay his sources.
Blogs have developed a reputation for being fun, quick, but also nasty. Exposing unpleasant truths about people, saying things which upset people.
We get a lot of complaints.
That's Gabby Derbyshire, the chief operating officer and the lawyer who fields all Gawker Media's legal threats.
There's no publisher in the world that will take down a story simply because the subject doesn't like what was said about them. So most of them go nowhere.
So, despite objections, Gawker posted the Scientology recruitment video Tom Cruise didn't want you to see.
My opinion is that, look, you're either on board or you're not on board, okay? But just, if you're on board, you're on board just like the rest of us, period.
Sarah Palin's private emails, Brett Favre's stalking of a sideline reporter, we've made our names for the wider public on these stories.
For years, Gawker's empire has built an audience of millions of monthly readers, largely by posting a flurry of caustic takes on stories pulled from other places. But now there'll be just one big story splashed across the front of each of Gawker's sites. Denton is intending to showcase writers who do deeper, original reporting.
It makes a lot of sense for 2011.
Ken Doctor is a digital media industry analyst for the consulting firm Outsell.
It's actually right in line with what we're seeing from other older legacy branded media.
Denton wants the Gawker sites to draw in upscale readers who see themselves interested in more than just gossip, and the advertisers who want to reach them.
I would like to show the full range of content from scurrilous and sensationalist through to beautiful and uplifting. Because people can't live on snark and vicious gossip alone.
As it turns out, even the bad boy of online snark is starting to sound suspiciously grown up. For NPR News, I'm Jesse Baker.
Later this week, the focus of the tech industry will be on Las Vegas. Every January, the industry decamps to Vegas for the Consumer Electronics Show, or CES. It's the largest showcase for just about anything you can plug into an electrical outlet or sync with your wireless. NPR's Laura Seidel is headed there tomorrow, and before she gets on a plane, she's joining us from San Francisco to talk about what's coming up at CES. And Laura, what are you most looking forward to checking out at CES this year?
Well, besides the robot that does massage, which should be really exciting, you know, one of the things, they're having a special section devoted to internet-connected appliances. So, you know, your refrigerator could talk to your Facebook page. I think more importantly, what they're ultimately aiming for with some of these appliances is, for example, you could have a dryer that would let the grid know, and the grid would talk back to you. There'd be a conversation, and basically you could say, this is a peak time to run your dryer. This is a time when, you know, the grid would prefer it, things like that. Or it could let you know, for example, if you were out of milk, things like that. So that's something I'm looking forward to. I think that's all kind of interesting and exciting and futuristic and new.
Laura, let's talk about somebody who will not be at CES this year. That's Apple. They don't go to trade shows. They do their own thing. But we're all keeping in mind the huge success of the Apple iPad. They sold, what, 7.5 million iPads in the first 6 months that it was on the market. That's just before the holiday shopping season. So what kind of competition do you think Apple will be getting for its iPad coming out of CES?
Quite a lot. What Apple proved is that there's a real category for this. A lot of people are really interested in it. So you're going to see tons of tablets. You saw some last year. You know, it was a big deal. But now everybody knows they've taken off. But what you will see that'll be great is you're going to see tablets that have cameras on them. So there'll be a camera maybe for taking a picture. There'll also be a camera for doing a video chat. Pretty much every manufacturer is coming out with tablets this year, and you're going to have some with an Android operating system. Microsoft is going to announce its Windows 7 is going to be used now for tablets. So tablets will be everywhere.
What about, Laura, what's new in the world of television? What kinds of advances in the world of TV are we looking at?
You know, overall, I would say that this year, you're not going to see anything fabulously new. It's all incremental. So last year, we saw 3D TV. We're going to see more 3D TV. Last year, we saw internet-connected TV. We're going to see more internet-connected TV. Mm-hmm. The hope is that Google was going to be there with Google TV, but Google has kind of pulled out. So that's taken a little bit of the wind out of the sails of the internet-connected TV. Still, probably within the next 5 years, about 50% of televisions are going to be connected to the internet in one form or another. Right now, what you're largely seeing is kind of, you know, here's an app for movies or an app for Yahoo or things like that. So it's not like a direct connection. And of course, more and more HD TVs. And every year it's like, which television is the biggest television? And you'll see all that kind of stuff.
Now, last year, Laura, CES was a little more subdued because of the down economy. What's it looking like this year in terms of scale and how bullish people are feeling about tech?
It's looking good. This year, clearly, the economy is recovering, and you're seeing that at CES. So there's going to be 1.6 million square feet of display space there, and that's kind of a record. And I'm thinking, all right, get on my comfortable shoes, because I'm going to be doing a lot of walking looking at all those gadgets this year.
Okay, Laura, have a good time.
All right, thanks so much.
It's NPR's Laura Seidel, who is headed tomorrow to Las Vegas for the Consumer Electronics Show.